Good evening, and welcome to our second call-in of our second call-in series. We're delighted tonight to have Dr. Michelle Gallietta with us, who is an expert on a borderline personality disorder and aggression. And before she starts, I just want to welcome all of you, and also to let people know that the Gunderson residents at McLean Hospital are helping to co-sponsor these series, so we're very appreciative. We also hope that some of you will help sponsor these series by sending in donations. I think, as you know, we're an all-volunteer organization, and any donations that you give go directly back to services to all of you. So we hope you'll think of going to our donate button and clicking on. Next week, we have Dr. Alec Miller, who'll be talking about adolescence, and also want to remind you that tonight is the last night to get the early registration fee in for our conference that's being held in White Plains on March 9th. So we hope some of you will be able to join us on that. It's now my pleasure to welcome you, Michelle, and I'd like to invite you to give us some information about yourself so we make sure we don't miss anything that would be helpful for us to know about you. And thank you for giving of your time and effort to make this call happen.
No problem, Perry. Thank you. It's so nice to be here. Can you all hear me okay?
You won't know because everyone's on mute, but they can send
me
an email if they can't. Send an email to neabpd@aol.com. I hear you, and I'm assuming, Jim, you do too?
Loud and clear.
Beautiful.
Great. Okay. So I am a clinical psychologist. The area of specialization that I kind of have pursued is forensic psychology, so any area of psychology that has an overlap with the law. So that could be civil cases or criminal cases. So I have done a lot of work in correctional environments as well as just kind of regular hospital environments. For the last decade or so, I've been a consultant for behavioral tech in Seattle, the company founded by Marsha Linehan. I'm no longer with them at this point, but I really, in those 10 years, have consulted and developed dialectical behavior therapy programs and other types of interventions, straight behavior therapy, and other types of environments in a variety of settings, mostly with adolescents and adults with pervasive emotion dysregulation of some sort or another. So I've also been, for the last 5 years, doing a trial funded by the National Institute of Mental Health comparing dialectical behavior therapy with anger management. And we're just wrapping up that trial for a variety of types of people. So kind of my passion is kind of research to practice. So the idea of taking what we know from research and making it fit in the real world, which is often can be challenging because the constraints of the real world are very different than a research lab. So I'm really happy to be here tonight. The goal for what I'd like to talk about this evening are really to look at the relationship between aggression and borderline personality disorder. So first we want to begin with a good definition of aggression, which is actually harder to do than one would think if you actually start looking up what people mean by that word. We're going to distinguish anger, the emotion, from aggression or aggressive behavior, and then discuss evidence-based treatments for aggressive behavior. Finally, concluding with an understanding of how dialectical behavior therapy could be useful in terms of changing aggressive behaviors, especially for clients with pervasive emotion dysregulation or borderline personality. So if we go to the first slide, it's slide 3, actually, aggression. This is a Webster Dictionary definition of aggression. So if you read the first one, a forceful action or procedure as an unprovoked attack, especially when intended to dominate or master. So the problem with this definition is that as a behaviorist, when I'm looking at someone's behavior, I cannot, I can't know their motivation unless I ask them. The second definition, hostile, injurious, or destructive behavior or outlook, especially when caused by frustration. again, I don't, that's getting closer to a good definition, but I would need a lot of information from the person doing the behavior to know whether they were experiencing frustration. So then I went to actually my son's dictionary. I have an 8-year-old, so this is a children's dictionary, and looked at the next slide, aggression, an attack made without reasonable cause. So I guess that would mean that violence in the course of what we would consider reasonable might not be considered aggression, so I guess in a war or something like that. However, who's going to determine whether something is reasonable? So this, again, the definition is a little problematic. The practice of making attacks, hostile or destructive behavior or outlook. So number three, it's getting a little bit more simple. And I know I'm kind of being very particular, but one of the things that DBT therapists do is that we really try to place a high emphasis on clarity and precision. It becomes really important when people are talking about clients who engage in aggressive behavior or when people are talking about their behaviors. I travel around a lot to different hospitals and will review charts in the case of in some of the times the types of cases I will be consulting on. And you'll see words in the charts like acted out, patient acted out, patient acted aggressively, patient, you know, postured. And all of those are things that could mean a lot of different behaviors. I don't know, you know, whether these are mild or aggressive. And so we're going to try one more definition if we go down to slide number 5. Aggression behavior that's hostile, destructive, and or violent. Generally, this behavior has potential to inflict injury or damage to the target person or the object. So this includes both kind of interpersonal behaviors, like saying hurtful things, all the way up to kind of property destruction or violence. So this is a nice broad definition. This comes from a BPD website, actually. So I think this is the one that we're going to be using. So it's basically what we're going to be talking about. If we go to the next slide, slide number 6, is a whole continuum of behaviors, ranging from mild everyday behaviors to all the way up to severe life-threatening physical harm. And in the course of my work and in the therapy I've done and the research that I've done, I have worked with folks with these very mild behaviors, kind of cursing and yelling because they're frustrated, all the way up to people have killed folks. And what's interesting about this is that the mechanisms and the kind of the whole process by which this happens, it's not all that different. It's also not that different. Every one of us has angry feelings and actually engages in aggressive behaviors, at least in their mild form. So, for instance, my first example here, I spend a lot of time in academia, in academic settings, and I'll be sitting in meetings and someone will present something and another person will raise their hand and say, I find it very interesting that you chose to look at the data that way. That's a direct hit. In my world, that's kind of a very aggressive thing to say or do, but it's said in a completely controlled and a professional, theoretically professional way. So what I'm hoping that you see on this list of examples is that we're not talking about qualitatively different things when we're talking about the link between kind of being angry and then acting in a particular way. We're talking about usually quantity or extent of the damage. And so the folks that get themselves into a lot of trouble are those who have the same degree of anger, maybe more intense, maybe not, than many of us, but actually less control over what to do with that anger. So if we look at the whole continuum, we could start with kind of just a hurtful barb directly, ad hominem attacks, you are a bitch, screaming, yelling, slamming doors, property destruction, throwing things, threatening to harm someone in a credible way, or actually physically harming someone. So these are all the gamut of the behaviors we're going to be talking about today. important when we're thinking about aggression. So we're going to be talking mostly about aggression related to folks with skills deficits around managing emotions. But if you were thinking about the broad world of why someone might engage in aggressive behavior, aggressive behaviors can be determined by lots of different things, even in the same person. So on a different day, different things might be impacting the aggressive behavior. But if one is going to be successful at changing these behaviors, because I've done units for folks, developed units for people with borderline personality disorder or the like, but also for maybe patients with psychosis who are aggressive or demented adults. And so it's really important to the extent possible to determine the etiology of the aggressive behavior in order to successfully address it. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go to the etiology, go back to the etiology and process it. So, for instance, if one was abused in childhood and has observed a lot of aggressive antisocial behaviors, it doesn't mean we have to actually go back and talk about childhood to change it. But it's important to know what seems to be driving the aggressive behavior. So things like brain conditions, delirium, intoxication, side effects to medication, like akathisia, being very uncomfortable, wanting to jump out of your skin, dementia, psychoses, mania. Also instrumental aggression, where there may not be emotion dysregulation involved, but where someone has a heroin habit and needs to get their next fix, and so carefully kind of plans to rob someone. That's a different type of behavior, but another reason that one could. In borderline personality disorder, we know that a relationship exists between very strong emotions, specifically anger, but not only anger, and aggressive behaviors. And yet they're very distinct. I was observing a grandma who was taking care of her little grandson, and he was refusing to listen to her, and he screamed, and I think he kind of slapped her when she tried to get him to do what she wanted. And she said, "You are a very angry little boy. Stop being angry with grandma." Now, the problem with this statement is that it confabulates anger and aggression, and it punishes the anger as opposed to the behavior that he was doing, which was not listening and hitting the grandma. And this actually is a problem that exists not only in this little dyad, but in the literature at times. You will read about anger and aggression kind of getting lumped together in some of the literature, and certainly in a lot of nomenclature and in notes in hospitals and in the way we think about people and their behavior. There are several evidence-based treatments for folks with aggressive behavior. Anger management, interestingly, has positive, good effect for some populations and not so much for others. So anger management, fairly effective with people with some cognitive impairment. Not so effective at all for dyads where there's domestic violence in the relationship. So many of the clients that I have seen in some of the correctional settings have been through multiple trials of anger management. And for those with borderline personality disorder, I'll be talking a little bit later about why that hasn't always worked for them. But if all you're teaching someone about is anger, and some of the problems with emotions that they have involve other emotions like shame and fear, you're going to be unsuccessful if you only address the anger. So also, anger management doesn't involve same kinds of goal settings as some of the other treatments that are more comprehensive. Doesn't involve motivation enhancement, trying to get people committed to changing their anger, not because anger is a bad thing or because they're a bad person, but because those behaviors are largely inconsistent with a kind of a happy, goal-driven life. Straight behaviorism, cognitive behavior therapy works really well for, again, cognitively impaired folks, people with kind of whose anger and aggression comes largely from frustration. However, the problems are for people with a whole host of behaviors or for whom anger is just kind of one side small piece of multi-problem behaviors, those treatments generally are not comprehensive enough to have good effect. So I think we'll start to move on and look at the DSM, and specifically those treatments do not have good effect with folks with borderline personality disorder. So I've put here the slide from the DSM for borderline personality disorder. I apologize, it's a very busy slide, but I wanted you to just focus on number 8 because one of the criteria for borderline personality disorder is inappropriate anger or difficulty controlling anger. For instance, frequent displays of temper, constant anger, recurrent physical fights. So I'm not sure what inappropriate anger is, because I think one of the things about emotions are that they are kind of, they're directed by our learning history and by our individual biologies, and so I'm not sure what's an inappropriate amount of anger. We can have the research on emotion suggests that there's a natural, a normal curve of emotion, with some people being less sensitive and other people being more sensitive, and that curve, bell curve of normal distribution of intensity of affect, is pretty consistent with many, many traits in the world, and that there are people at all ends of the continuum for the most part, except the very, very maybe extremes on either end, who do fine in the world. In other words, anger is not the same thing as functionality, and you can be a person with quite intense emotions and be quite successful. So while I'm not crazy about this definition, the point is that there is a link between borderline personality disorder and anger, and so it's one of those things, anger and aggression, that we need to learn a little bit more about. And yet it's one that people have a harder time with anger than other behaviors. I see in the patients that I treat, a lot of times people have self-harm evokes sympathy from other people, and anger and aggressive behavior evokes judgment from people most of the time. So if we go to the, I'm sorry, I just popped up one slide too many. If we go to the next slide, I'm on my slide 10. This slide is heading borderline personality disorder. So Marsha Linehan, and I apologize if some of you may be very familiar with this, but it's a helpful review. She reorganized the criteria for borderline personality disorder, and that criteria 6, or it was about affective instability, in her thinking, was the central feature of borderline personality disorder, and an inability to manage intense affect. And all of the other criteria are seen to stem from that, or just a consequence of having intense emotions with little ability to effectively manage those emotions. So we'll talk the theory of borderline personality disorder and its etiology. We're going to spend some time looking at that, but if we're going to understand aggressive behaviors, it's very important to understand this biosocial theory of where emotion dysregulation comes from. So in this model, problem behaviors, any problem behavior, when she wrote the model, she was talking primarily about suicidal behavior and self-harm behaviors. These are seen as either a natural consequence of extreme dysregulation. So if we're thinking about aggression, if you think about a toddler who has not yet developed any way to manage emotion, and that toddler wants something and can't have it and is taken away from them, they are going to become aggressive. Just, it's hardwired in us. It's the natural reaction. So that's the example of it being a natural consequence of an intense emotion. The other explanation for problem behaviors in this model is that the problem behavior functions in a way to regulate the emotions in the person. In other words, it helps them to calm down, helps them to escape an unpleasant emotion, or to kind of soothe the unpleasant emotion, largely to escape it. So an example of this might be cutting. when someone's in intense despair and one cuts, it actually relieves that emotion. It's important to note that in her model, the problem is not anger. Anger is not the problem, even intense anger. It's the inability to tolerate or manage the intense anger that is the problem. So it's a skills deficit model, as opposed to some kind of core pathology about the person. So going on to the next slide, to understand aggression. Aggression is a behavior like any other behavior. It must be understood in the context of borderline personality disorder as described above. So a pervasive dysregulation of affect. And as I mentioned earlier, people have a very hard time with aggressive behaviors, especially if they're directed towards us. So it's easy to see aggressive behaviors as bad. It's easy for us to assume motivation. This person was trying to intimidate me. This person treats me badly. This person doesn't respect me. And we focus on the consequence instead of the experience for the person. And the consequences are indeed important. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we must stop aggressive behavior. But it's as important that we understand the person who's experiencing, who's exhibiting the aggressive behaviors experience, because the response in most environments is to punish aggressive behavior. And the problem is if someone actually, if it's driven by a cue and something that comes before, we don't change what happens before the behavior, we don't give the person a way to recognize strong affect and calm themselves down, we can punish it all we want and it actually won't change. The other piece about this that's important is when someone is aggressive, we really look for public displays of remorse. And you know, when one has engaged aggressively, I've worked with countless clients that have kind of done things that were quite aggressive and really never publicly looked remorseful, because it's hard to live with themselves. And so there's this kind of public shame that happens, and the experience of shame makes one want to withdraw and close up and close off. And so sometimes our assessment of what someone's experience of having done something hurtful is, said something hurtful, she says these things to me and she doesn't even feel bad. We don't often know what the actual experience is unless we ask. And that's why we do a lot of inquiring in therapy. Okay, so I'm now going to just do a little bit of review about DBT, because DBT is the modality that I have been using for the last several years in my research and in consultation to help clients to learn how to undo aggressive behaviors. So I know many of you know a lot about dialectical behavior therapy, but I'm going to just do a quick review. So it is a behavior therapy with the addition of acceptance technology, largely mindfulness and other Zen-based principles and practices. The main strategy of acceptance we use in dialectical behavior therapy is called validation, where we convey to the person what is reasonable about their position. We'll talk more about that in a little bit. And the thing that kind of uses these two fairly disparate approaches, behavior therapy, which pushes for change and is very structured, pretty rigid, and then these philosophies of acceptance and validation, the thing that fuses those two together is a philosophical approach of dialectics. It's a way of resolving tensions of opposites, and we have some time to talk about that as well. This next slide, slide 13, the triangle slide, is a very helpful slide in terms of keeping the frame of dialectical behavior therapy straight. So we have acceptance balanced with change. They balance each other out. And we have dialectics that actually is almost like the seesaw that tells you when to do, if you're kind of too much pushing for change, the seesaw would be off balance, and dialectics would say you need to kind of actually do a little bit of acceptance to even it out. Okay, I have a repeat slide. I don't know if you guys do as well. On 14, it was the same slide I just did, so we'll jump down. I apologize, there's a couple of, I found two repeats in here. DBT is a package of treatment components, and so it's very important if someone says that they've had this and it doesn't work for them, that you actually assess, did they actually have comprehensive dialectical behavior therapy, or did they get a little bit of group skills training, which is quite common, that many places just offer skills groups. Having skills groups without comprehensive treatment is kind of like going to Weight Watchers and going to the meeting, but not actually changing your diet and not actually having someone to talk to when you have urges to overeat. So it's real important to assess, and there's a function for each one of these pieces of the treatment. The individual therapist is really kind of the cheerleader who gets the client hooked in. And so when I was alluding earlier to motivational strategies, there are strategies we use in dialectical behavior therapy to take a client who has engaged in aggressive behaviors and other behaviors and to kind of really have lots of conversation about how those are incompatible with whatever life it is that they want. And they almost inevitably are, but you sometimes have to make that link for the client. So the individual therapist is responsible for doing that. The client also gets skills training, which is a didactic lecture with homework and practice, and it focuses on four different modules for adolescents, five modules, where we teach a bunch of different skills: mindfulness, distress tolerance, emotion regulation, and interpersonal effectiveness. For adolescents and families, we also do what we call walking the middle path dialectics, where we teach dialectics and validation. I will say a little bit about that when we get to the validation slide. It's important to note that the whole range of emotions are taught in this class, as it were, and that in my experience working with aggression, it's really helpful to have information on the whole range of emotions. The next piece that the clients get is coaching. So they have the ability to call their therapist on the phone when they notice that they're getting upset in some way, sad, angry, anxious, and they don't know what to do and they're having urges, they can contact their therapist. The interesting thing is that many of our clients, particularly with aggressive behaviors, they're quite impulsive. So there's an urge, an emotion of anger, and then almost immediately an action, slamming a door, screaming at someone. And so some of the modules, the mindfulness, actually focuses on slowing down the person in the moment, having them observe the angry emotion before the action comes. And so that takes a while. It takes a lot of training to get the person to actually observe their own body so that the space between the urge to do something aggressive and the act is kind of, there's a choice point in there. Obviously, if the other piece is really important is the consultation team. This is especially important if you're working with clients who engage in aggressive behaviors, because therapists, like family members and partners and other people, don't like to be treated aggressively. And so it's for clients who have a high degree of aggression, a lot of verbal attacking or worse, it's really important to have a team to keep you grounded so that you don't get you don't either get intimidated by this person, this person and their behavior, or judgmental and angry and really not wanting to attack back. This last mode, where you'll see a little asterisk on the slide, egregious behaviors protocol, this is used almost exclusively in inpatient or residential settings, and this is so that the setting itself doesn't get undone by aggressive behaviors and also self-harm behaviors and property destruction. In the event of these serious behaviors, there's a kind of a standard way of operating so that there doesn't have to be special meetings or the like. We want to avoid crisis-driven behaviors, and it has a client do a chain analysis of their behavior, which we are going to actually look at one in a little bit. you can use them for not severe behaviors. And the example we do is going to be one that's not so severe, but in an inpatient setting, if someone were to have picked up a chair and thrown it across the room and at someone, the client would have to do a chain to understand what happened so that it would be less likely that they would engage in that behavior again. Let's see. Okay, the other thing, I'm not going to go into these targets very much, but on the next slide, which is headed stage one primary targets, the important thing to note about this is that treatment targets are hierarchically organized so that you're not talking about someone wanting a new boyfriend if they've engaged in serious self-harm that week or serious aggressive behavior, so that these things are kind of tiered. In DBT, things that have the potential for actual violence, actual threat to life of other people would be considered life-threatening behaviors and the very top of the priorities, as well as self-harm behaviors like suicide and serious self-harm. Many of the aggressive behaviors we're going to treat and we're talking about and that are going to be the ones that plague people in their homes and in relationships are actually quality of life interfering behaviors. If the aggression is directed towards the therapist, then it would rise to the therapy interfering behaviors. If you're wondering why it would be more serious for the therapist, it's simply that then there's a real risk that the client drops out of therapy, and it's likely that the client could end up dead or, at the very least, not benefiting from the therapy. So that's why we would address that above quality of life interfering behaviors. Okay, so to summarize, if a client is getting DBT, they get all the components of DBT, including skills coaching. The therapists are part of a consultation team. The case is well conceptualized, so the whole gamut of the person's behaviors are conceptualized, along with an understanding of where each behavior comes from and what's caused it in the past and what's likely to decrease it. So what are the targets to decrease or increase to produce a change in the behavior? Individual sessions use this case conceptualization and treatment targets, as well as weekly diary cards to assess, which are kind of mood tracking, urge tracking, urges to quit therapy, urges to self-harm, urges to harm people. And they keep track of these every week, and the therapist uses that to determine what to talk about in session each week based on that hierarchy. Therapists use both change strategies like CBT strategies, which we have a slide about coming up, validation, as well as other strategies, all to move their client forward. Okay, so now we move into specifically what are the adaptations or the way that DBT thinks about aggression. So the standard biosocial theory in DBT says that there's a biological sensitivity or a vulnerability which transacts over time with an invalidating environment to produce a person who is pervasively emotionally dysregulated, a person who gets upset easily and who has very little ability to manage those emotions once they get upset, and so they stay upset. So let's talk for a minute about what we mean by biological vulnerability. This would be a child, as I was talking about the normal temperament curve, who would be on the sensitive side, who would take a lot more to soothe them in infancy, perhaps. This can be just normal temperament. It can also be created in utero with substance use by mother, fetal alcohol syndrome, or crack cocaine can make someone more sensitive to stimuli from the environment. Anoxia can give someone can change the emotion system. And trauma, early trauma. So we're not always talking about prenatal period when we mean biological vulnerability. And this is kind of a tricky concept, but trauma can actually change one's biological vulnerability so that your biological system is kind of, until an intervention, permanently changed so that they do have the same sort of quick reaction, slow return to baseline, and kind of a very fast, if you want to think of it as a fast emotion system. The invalidating environment does not have to be necessarily a bad environment. There are all kinds of complex ways in which the biology interacts with the environment. So a biologically vulnerable child is much more challenging to find the way to soothe that child. In other words, to separate the emotion from to soothe the emotion and provide the child modeling for how to calm themselves down, it's a lot harder to soothe a child with a lot of biological vulnerability. And sometimes other things happen that make it hard. So let me give you an example. I treated a boy who was 8. He was sexually abused by a cousin who was 17 and in the home. And mom found out about this because she heard them fighting over a video game. And the young boy said, "If you don't give me that Xbox, I'm going to tell mom what you did to me." The mother kind of asked what happened, found out what was going on, picked cousin out of the home, did all the right things that you would expect a mom to do, went to the police, got the child treatment at the hospital, and went through the whole court case with him. He came into treatment. He was having problems in school. He was encopredic. He was going to the bathroom in his pants. He was getting mocked in school because he smelled. And so he was getting somatic and going to the nurse, saying he was sick. And then mom would get called from work to pick him up, and he wasn't sick. He was upset. And so mom's response was kind of uncharacteristic of all the other things she had done. She had said, "If you can't take care of yourself, if you can't fight for yourself, I'm gonna hit you at home." So some of this was kind of culturally consistent with her beliefs that men should be strong. And it was related to the fact that she was terribly upset that her son had been victimized and felt like it was partly her fault because she was a single mom. So she had a hard time being okay with his vulnerability. So if he was sad at home that something happened to him, that was okay. But if he was weak or scared outside of the home, she couldn't, that was not acceptable. And she couldn't validate that feeling at all as reasonable. At the same time, he started to get really aggressive with his younger sister at home, the only person it was safe to get aggressive with. And that was met with, "You need to stop that. That's bad. You're a bad boy. You used to be a nice boy." So you can see how this is all very reasonable. But what ended up getting punished was every emotion that this kid had in response to the experience. What was meaning get punished was just the behavior. But because the emotion and the behavior didn't get separated out, he ended up having really a lot of invalidation over time. And the more he was invalidated, the worse his behavior got. The worse his behavior got, the more angry his mom got at him and really thought that he was turning into an aggressive, bad kid. And so you can see that they just kind of got on a path where one side amplified the other in a negative way. The good news is that can really be, if we just kind of talk about that and teach people how to validate the emotion, not the behavior, it can work. And it did work out much better once we looked at it that way. Okay, so the problem is once a kid has this syndrome of emotion dysregulation, they can't reorient their attention. So they're angry, someone does something to them, they can become really perseverative, and it's not fair, and they can't bring their brain to something else, to anything else. So behaving in a way that is not focused on that emotion, and the whole emotion is telling them to attack. You know what I mean? When we get angry, we're hardwired to attack. So ceasing to do that is not attainable for many kids with this problem and adults as they grow up. Then their long-term goals are not attained, and this creates a sense of hopelessness that you know, no matter what they do, it's not right. I've had so many patients say, this is just me. This is who I am. So this kind of sense of powerlessness that if someone makes me mad, I'm a bad person. I'm just going to react. And so, therefore, I'm kind of stuck in the world being this bad person. That's who I'm going to be. So the acceptance strategies in DBT convey acceptance through treating the client first at its most basic level as if they're okay, as if they're worthy of attention and respect. At the most extreme end of aggression and aggressive behavior, even this is not possible because most people are treated as an offender, not as a person who has done some things. And so it makes it really hard for them to accept any change-oriented interventions from people because they're not accepted as a person. And they then don't accept themselves as people sometimes. Sometimes they just kind of don't like the rest of the world. It's finding the piece of truth or wisdom in a client's behavior. So you want to say, what is wise about cursing at your parents and throwing something? Probably not a lot is wise about the behavior. In fact, nothing is. But is there anything wise if there was an argument before and the kid was trying to talk and the parent didn't understand their perspective? It's reasonable that they would be upset. Not reasonable to throw the stuff, but it's reasonable to be upset. So where does this, where this gets tricky is in aggression. It's really hard to know how to validate an emotion, but not the behavior that's attached with the emotion. In other words, where do you put the period? How do you kind of insert, I understand you were really angry, and you can't hit your sister? So that was kind of, the and is okay, but most of us, it comes out as a big but, and we kind of skip the, I understand you're upset. You can't do that. That's unacceptable. And so the alternate is true, is I've seen people actually, I understand you were upset, you have problems controlling your feelings, and then there's no consequence for the behavior. So, you know, as a therapist, we don't want to just say, uh-huh, I understand, yep, that person made you upset, because now we've validated as reasonable the behavior that follows the emotion. So the whole trick here is really to validate emotion but not behavior. As people say, like when people say things that are really outrageous, it's really hard to know how to do this. It takes a lot of practice and a lot of skill to kind of insert the right way to do that without feeling like you're punishing the person or you're kind of giving approval to the behavior. And some of it is in our head. It's actually saying to someone, I understand you're upset. Makes sense you're upset. And just putting a period, that doesn't imply approval of the behavior, but we kind of, in our heart, we feel like it might. And so we say, but. And so the idea is to just say that and take a breath and wait a second. And then we can move on to, now what are we going to do about this? Because we can't have you hitting your sister, that sort of thing. Okay. In order to work with people with aggression, it's very helpful to take the standard DBT assumptions about clients and put them in our head. So if you see these assumptions 1 through 7, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go through them much more, but I just want you to see them. And it's really, really important that we understand that clients are doing the best they can. We don't have a hard time believing number 6, that they need to be harder and they need to try harder, they need to do better. We do have a hard time believing that they are doing the best that they can. And sometimes when they don't display remorse, we have a hard time believing that they want to improve. All right, so if we want to change these behaviors, it's really super important that we understand this emotion-behavior link and that the clients understand the emotion-behavior link. We have to teach clients and we have to learn to separate the emotion from the action. In order to do this, you have to have a non-judgmental stance about things that sometimes are quite hurtful to us, to our colleagues, to siblings in a home, and that doesn't mean we don't want the behavior to change. It just means it's not going to change if we get judgmental and accusatory about the behavior. It's going to make the person defensive. And we have to understand what the behavior is doing for the person. Is the behavior calming them down? Is the behavior getting them something that is a pleasurable consequence at the end? We have to look at that. Okay, so this slide on emotions, this just says what I have alluded to earlier about emotions being a full system response. If there's a trigger in the environment, that triggers an urge. And any emotion, anger, the urge is to attack. Fear, the urge is to run away. We need to teach people to recognize the body sensations associated with the urge. And we need them to recognize the urge. And then also the action. And to recognize that those are two separate things. And through teaching mindfulness, we can kind of increase the space between those two boxes. I'm just going to fly through this changing behavior slide. These are standard change strategies we use to change aggression. But the important thing I wanted you guys to look at is this chain analysis of behavior. So you'll see this kind of notion that there's things that make us more vulnerable to snap. If you think of any of us, if we're tired, if we're hungry, we're much more likely to engage in a problematic behavior. We're going to be short. Same is true for everyone, especially if there's prompting events, something that makes us upset. So the important thing is to notice which end of the chain is driving a behavior. Is it the consequences? Every time I yell at someone, they go away, and that's really good for me because I didn't really want them around. Or is it I'm just frustrated, and when I'm frustrated, I yell. And I just didn't think about it. I didn't control it. And then whatever happens, happens. Important because we can change it better if we understand which one of those things is operating. Okay, so I just wanted to quickly look at this slide of a young girl that I worked with. So I'm going to walk you through this behavior. She stayed up texting real late, was very tired, was sleeping, and mom banged on her door and said, "You need to get up for school." She actually recalls feeling startled and her heart kind of racing, and the next thing she remembers is being quite annoyed and feeling irritable. And then she had a thought. She's always bossing me around. And before she knew it, she said, "I hate you. Leave me alone." And got back up and slammed the door that her mother had opened. Her mom says, "You can't talk to me this way." And I actually left out a link here. What happened next was that she screamed back another curse at her mom. And then she started to get ready, and then she started to think about what happened and felt very guilty about what she had done. She was sad and despairing. She started to have a lot of self-judgment, and then she couldn't get dressed for school. She was late for school, and one of the other consequences was she had a detention. So if we wanted to undo this aggressive behavior, there's many, many ways we could do this, right? But we could knock out the vulnerability of staying up late. We could teach her to recognize the feeling of annoyance first, to recognize even at the feeling startled with her heart racing. So we would basically teach, if we go to the next slide, you'll see all the ways we can decrease vulnerability factors. We can we could do exposure to the prompting event. If we wanted to, we could see how if mom could wake her up in a different way, or maybe cue an alarm clock to wake her up differently. We could teach mindfulness to observe these emotions, and we could also work on the consequences, highlighting aversives, decreasing reinforcement. If she doesn't like school, then it's actually going to be more likely that this whole little scenario plays out over and over again. So I realize this is a very, very fast kind of spin through this, but you get a little feeling of how we look at what prompts the aggressive behavior, and then we actually work on some skills that would help the client to decrease the behavior. Notice that it's not about how you think the other person felt, do you feel bad for it. It's not about remorse, because folks often have quite a lot of remorse. They just don't have the skills to do things differently, even if they want to. Okay, so if we go to the summary slide, aggression, like anything else, any other behavior, it's likely to bring with it future invalidation from other people. In other words, when someone's already behaved aggressively in the past, people hold a grudge. If people hold a grudge, they're going to treat you in a way that makes it more likely that you have animosity with them in the future. So it creates a cycle that's very hard. If the person experiences a lot of shame about their aggression, it makes it more difficult to treat because they don't want to go back and talk about it or look at their behavior. So then we also need to address the shame as well. We need to focus on the whole range of emotions, not just anger, and make sure that we're working on the right part of the chain, that we don't just punish aggressive behaviors. If the person needs to learn skills, we've got to work on the first part of that chain. We also have to remember that people working with and living with individuals without a lot of emotion regulation who are engaging in aggressive behaviors need a lot of support, because sometimes there's nothing you can do to change the behavior. There are things you could do to kind of make a situation worse, and we can talk about those if people have questions. But it's a very difficult situation to be in with someone as they're learning, because you're oftentimes subjected to behaviors that are really not fair and don't feel good. And the last thing is that, in my experience, comprehensive treatment is really much more effective than just skills alone for this problem. So I'm happy to take some questions.
Oh, Michelle, this was absolutely wonderful. Just wonderful. Just, you went through, and it's just, it's such a nice trajectory to watch how this all unfolds. Are there any articles out there that people could read on the work that you've done?
Most of the stuff that I've published is on the real extreme end of aggression. So there's an article out on that I have just published on stalking behavior. So I don't know how helpful that's going to be. I'm actually on sabbatical this semester and hoping to write some of this stuff up.
Oh, that'd be terrific. And maybe then you'd send us a link or something where we can post it on our website.
Definitely.
All right. So we have some questions for sure. Other than that, how can family members best be integrated into the therapy process to support the goal of lowering aggressive tendencies?
So I think if we go back to the idea of validation and invalidation, one of the things that it definitely increases aggressive behavior in clients with pervasive development, pervasive emotion dysregulation, is invalidation, invalidating someone. Now, we know that you can, if somebody, you know, getting up for school can be an invalidating experience for that girl in my chain. That doesn't mean you don't get a child up for school. It just means thinking about the way in which it's done, saying, I know it's hard to get up, and yet it's time to get up, not startling a child with kind of high sensitivity. So understanding what is validating or invalidating for a family member, and then trying whenever possible not to invalidate that person. But that doesn't mean giving the person whatever they want. Do you see there's this kind of balance? And so I think just learning skills together is an amazing way to demonstrate, because and having the person with emotion dysregulation see that everybody has aggressive feelings and how we deal with them in a non-judgmental way. Not I handle my emotions, but, oh, here's what I do when I get really frustrated with your father, can be really helpful.
Okay. Which co-occurring disorders complicate issues of BPD and aggression?
Well, certainly any kind of head trauma. If there's a kind of a frontal lobe problem or cognitive impairment can make it more. It's not that it cognitive impairment or anything that increases impulsivity can make it harder to treat, but not impossible. What you were looking for is cognitive impairment can make it harder to learn the skills. There's a wonderful, wonderful researcher named Julie Brown who has developed a really nice, very, very simple skills that were derived from DBT skills, but they're much, much simpler and a way to teach to even a quite compromised folks with cognitive impairment. So her stuff is all available on Amazon, and that's, to me, that's what, when people say, oh, this person's beyond help, and I get calls for, you know, cases, a lot of times it's because they're cognitively impaired. Yeah, people just kind of write them off, and it takes more behavioral stuff, more repetition, slower, slower teaching and simpler skills, but it can be done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any medications that you would suggest or class of medications that effectively reduce aggressive tendencies or characteristics?
So I am not a psychiatrist. My husband actually is a forensic psychiatrist and does a lot of treatment of aggressive patients. And there are classes of medications. It's similar to borderline personality disorder in that it's not a genetically based disorder like schizophrenia that has a whole class of medications and a theory behind why it works. So they tend to target symptoms of impulsivity or irritability, which can be targeted with a bunch of different things, sometimes SSRIs, sometimes other things which can cause other problems, tranquilizers, long-acting tranquilizers. So I think that it is helpful to have a good psychopharmacologist kind of consulting on cases, and it's also really helpful to make sure that one isn't taking something that kind of increases irritability. So some clients can have atypical reactions to benzodiazepines, which actually cause aggression and irritability. So you want to really, it's very helpful to have someone who actually knows a bit about aggression if one has a lot of aggression and impulsivity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can someone giving the silent treatment or ending a relationship abruptly be seen as a form of aggression, or is this behavior characteristic of some other maladaptive behavior?
It can be, absolutely. It depends. Now, this is one of those things where you'd have to actually have a chain analysis on what the client's thinking, what the person's thinking when they end a relationship abruptly. But if they're thinking, I will get them and they'll be sorry and they'll miss me, then it's definitely aggressive. It could also be that the same behavior is because they're hurt and they're sad, and then it's not meant to be aggressive. So, but by the definition we had in the beginning, if it causes the other person harm, then it is. But I think that is caused generally, that kind of like cutting off one's nose to spite their face, like cutting people off by a lack of skills, mm-hmm. a lack of not understanding how to get one's needs met in a relationship, not understanding how to convey what one didn't like about an interaction. And so that's why it's so important for patients who have a lot of aggression to have not just the skill about anger, to know mm-hmm. the whole host of emotions and to learn how to interact better with people. I think the tricky thing really, for family members that are living with even like the kind of slamming of the doors, like in that chain, it can create a really negative environment, one that's unpleasant and difficult to live with. And so, so the support is important, and really just doing what one can to not get caught in what would be a normal. If one is treated a little bit irritably or a little bit bad, then to not attack back is very hard to do, because it's a normal impulse for us to feel hurt. And when we're hurt, we're hardwired to be aggressive. Mm-hmm. And then everyone's aggressive. So it takes a lot of skill not to engage in something that kind of puts a match on the fire that's already there.
Okay. I guess along with that is how do you validate during an aggressive act?
So it's really important. You don't want to validate the behavior. You know, I went into one place, and this girl had they told me about a situation where a young girl had a chair over her head and was threatening the psychiatrist. And I said, well, what did you say? And they said, well, we want to be validating. We said, we understand you have a trauma history, and if it makes you feel safe to have the chair over your head, we get it, but we prefer you not hit the doctor. Well, that's kind of ridiculous. So, you know what I mean? I remember thinking, my grandma could have told you the right thing to do here, right? With no training. Like, and that is, put the chair down. So sometimes there's no room. When the person's already engaging the aggressive behavior, the deal is to manage it. Manage it for safety. If someone's treating you badly, you want to just kind of really avoid them. Now, that doesn't mean punish them in an aggressive way by saying, you're being so bad, so I'm walking away. It means as gently as possible avoiding the situation and saying, I can see you're really upset right now. I'm going to walk away. If they've already done the aggressive thing, really you just want to walk away and manage the situation. It's the kind of what's really helpful is validating when they're upset before or saying things in a validating way so as not to, you know, being non-judgmental in general, being careful with your words in general, not walking on eggshells, but just kind of thinking about if you're going to wake your kid up, not barking, not kind of, it's really avoiding the kind of pure law and order stance, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And last question, and then there's a statement. What role does the emotion of fear play in inducing aggression?
That's a phenomenal question. One of the things we're seeing a lot in our study, which is, again, with people that have aggressive behaviors from very mild, like texting someone something, all the way up to real serious violence. But one of the things I'm seeing in a lot of the male patients, this is true for women too, but really with a lot of the men, is that there are times they can use their skills to manage anger, and there are times they can't. And when we start looking at chains and looking at, well, what got in the way this time, it's frequently fear that produces an anger so quick and so fast that their skills are not useful. So they need extra skills to kind of bring it down. And many of them are people who have trauma histories or violence in their past, aggressive behaviors done towards them, or even have just witnessed a lot in neighborhoods with a lot of violence. And if they get afraid for their lives, so I had a guy who was cut off he was riding a motorcycle and someone cut him off in a car. And he was so frightened for 1 second, and he ended up punching the driver of the car. He, same guy, was in his motorcycle, and a woman hit him from behind, bumped him. Mm. And he didn't hit her because he didn't actually fear for his life. And so what we found was that when his heart started racing first, that just spiked aggression up very high. So this is a very interesting link, and this is, again, points to why would we want to teach people about things other than just anger?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because if you can control fear, if you can recognize fear and vulnerability and that flash, then the anger, the aggression that's so intense never comes. The anger doesn't come.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, great questions. Michelle, I don't even know what to say, but there was an email that came in that probably says it all. It says, thank you, that was fabulous.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. Thanks so much.
On the part of everyone who's on this call tonight and others that will have the good fortune as well to listen to it, I want to thank you, really. Thank you for your time, your expertise. It's not something that I don't think we've ever had a lecture in our conferences on aggression to this extent. So thank you for setting that high standard for us to be talking about this very important issue.
Thank you so much, and thanks for all the work that you've done in this area. It's amazing. It really is. I was happy to be involved.
Well, thank you, and we'll get you again, we hope.
Okay.
Okay, thanks, and good night to everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.